We're going to get the meeting for the Labor and Commerce Committee. We've gaveled in at 5:04. We have Senator Olson, Senator Michicki, and myself, Senator Dunleavy, so we do have a quorum. Today we're going to hear four bills, HB 84, Military Training Credit, Temporary License, HB 50, Multi-Unit Housing, Commercial Use, SB 8, Pharmacy Audits, and SB 25, Unemployment, Filing of Labor Information. So with that, we're going to turn to HB 84. We're going to have public testimony in HB 84 today as well. So HB 84 is sponsored by Representative Sadler, and he's here before us, and it's an act relating to applying military education, training, and service credits, occupational licensing, and certain post-secondary education and employment training requirements, providing for temporary occupational license for qualified military service members and providing for an effective date. This is a companion bill to SB 4, which the committee has heard previously. Some presenters, again, Representative Sadler and his staff, Kim Skipper. So please state your name for the record, give your testimony, and be prepared for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Representative Dan Sadler, House District 12, Eagle River. Thank you to Chair Dunleavy and members of the committee. I really appreciate you hearing the bill. Very briefly, the goal of House Bill 84 is to help separating service members transition quickly and effectively into the civilian workforce. Each year, about 1,200 service members separate from service in Alaska. And these gentlemen and ladies receive tremendously world-class training, education, and experience during their time in uniform. These are assets that shouldn't be lost to them or to our communities as they transition into civilian jobs and careers. This bill asks the Division of Professional Licensing, the University of Alaska, and the Department of Labor to evaluate military training and education, and where appropriate, directs them to assign civilian credit while protecting and not compromising current professional and occupational licensing standards. Now, service members often have delays and lose opportunities in qualifying for licenses and certificates and academic credit, even though they do have the applicable training and experience. This bill makes it more likely that vets can get jobs and advance their civilian careers by accelerating the licensing process and educational credits. In the news recently, force reductions, budget cuts, and sequestration mean there's going to be even more veterans seeking civilian jobs. There's 19 states that have passed similar legislation as of last July, and 30 states are considering it now. I think we have an obligation to find a way to give veterans every opportunity to leverage their time in service and their experience into academic credit, job certification, or vocational training credits. Bills like HB 84 make that happen to everyone's benefit. I appreciate your audience. I ask for your support and stand by for questions.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Questions from members of the committee for Representative Sadler?
I have one.
Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sadler, I think it's a good bill. I appreciate you bringing it forward. Tell me about temporary licenses. What kinds of licenses would be temporary? And obviously, they can be extended once, so it's a maximum amount of time for a temporary license for 1 year.
Right. Through the chair, Senator Michicki, that's ad. What are you going to do?
Thank you.
There are provisions for temporary licenses in the bill and elsewhere in statute. The kinds of boards that would to which this provision would apply include 13 different boards offering temporary licenses. They may be in your packet. They include audiologists, speech-language pathologists, hairdressers and barbers, dental examiners, guardians and conservators, nursing home administrators, veterinary examiners, chiropractic examiners, and others. The question was raised, I might anticipate your question, why 2 6-month extensions as opposed to 1 year? And the answer we got was 6 months seemed long enough, and they just want to make sure and have one more opportunity. And it could be either way, six or one and a half dozen the other,
Mr.
literally.
Chairman, and then the goal is to eventually get them permanently licensed with the state certification process.
That's correct.
For those. Thank you, sir.
Any additional questions from members of the committee at this time? Seeing none, thank you, Representative Sadler. Online is Mark with the Department of Defense online. Mark. Sansucci. Mark Sansucci.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mark, for the record, my name is Mark Sansucci, Department of Defense, regionally assigned for military families. I want to first say that you heard from me last Tuesday when this was Senate Bill 4. The Department of Defense supports Representative Sadler's House bill, even with the amended effective date, and we support everything he has said so far. We are trying to help reduce the unemployment rate of our new veterans, and this is one of those measures that helps them do that. And with military, just last year, who separated or retired back to Alaska, many in Anchorage and Fairbanks. We appreciate the consideration and support of these folks. In the last 2 years, 28 states enacted new laws to help grant our veterans credit towards academic credit and or occupational licensing. And so far in the 2013 session, a bunch more states have actually enacted this, including South Dakota, Utah, Wyoming, New Mexico, Montana, Mississippi, and Kentucky. And just one other point I'd like to make is it's important to reemphasize that you know that we're not asking for direct licensure if it's not equivalent. In cases where the regulatory agency or board determines partial credit, but it saves the veteran time and expense and helps them get to where they're intending to go, even if not completely, that's what we seek. We only are seeking credit where credit is due. We're not expecting an EMT to be certified as a nurse if, in fact, that's not an equivalent occupation or license credit. So last week, Senator Olson asked me a question about occupations that were not medical related, and I've been thinking about that for a week because I didn't like my answer to him last week, and I have to tell you that I think it depends on the state and what they regulate. In Washington State, a year or so ago, we passed a law that covered funeral directors, engineers, driver instructors, cosmetology, court reporters, private investigators, security guards, architects. And yet I would say that maybe your Bureau of Commerce is probably best equipped to answer Senator Olson's question from last week. You can tell that's been bothering me. So just want to let you know about my thoughts on that. And then otherwise, Mr. Chair, thank you for the consideration. I stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. And I have to do a backtrack. I should have opened it for public testimony, so it's officially open for public testimony. Testimony, and Mr. Sandsuchi was the was our first person to testify. Any questions for members of the committee? Seeing none. Any other additional folks that want to testify that are are there? We have a number of folks that are prepared to answer questions. Are there any questions for members of the committee for those folks online regarding the bill? I'm seeing papers come my way. So there are no folks online other than the folks that are there to answer questions for us, correct? Okay, so no questions for members of the committee?
One comment, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Machicki.
I just want to thank the representative for the record of revising the effective date so that this bill has no fiscal note for the state. I think that's an important point.
Okay, any additional questions or comments from members of the committee at this point regarding the bill? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Is there a motion?
There is a motion, Mr. Chair. Move HB 8428-LS0357U with individual recommendations and attach fiscal notes to the next committee of referral.
Is there an objection to the motion? Seeing none, HB 84 moves from committee. We're going to take a brief recess. Thank you.
Yay!
We are back in session. We're moving over to SB 8. It's sponsored by Senator Egan. It's an act establishing procedures and guidelines for auditing pharmacy records and providing for an effective date. This is the first hearing on the bill. We'll hear it today, and we'll hear it again in committee in the future. Please note that this is a sponsor substitute. Presenting the bill, Senator Egan and staff, Dana Owen. So with that, will representatives from Senator Egan's office come brief at ease? Is not here at the time, so we're going to move to SB 25. So, SB 25 is requested by the governor. It's an act relating to electronic filing of certain information with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development relating to surcharges, rate increases, reduction prohibition on the relief of certain charges, the unemployment trust fund account, and the offset of certain unemployment compensation debt under the Alaska Employment Security Act relating to the definition of covered unemployment compensation debt in the Alaska Unemployment Security Act and providing for an effective date. This is the first hearing on the bill. We, too, will hear this bill today and it's scheduled for the future. Presenting would be Bryn Keith, Acting Deputy Commissioner, Paul Dick, Director of the Employment Security Division, and Aisha Paulson, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. If the folks are here, could they please come forward, state name for the record, and please begin your testimony.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, Bryn Keith, Acting Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And with me this evening is Paul Dick, Director of our Division of Employment Security. On the line, we also have Aisha Paulson, Assistant Attorney General. The bill before you, Senate Bill 25, broadly speaking, does four things. It allows for the electronic filing of reports and documents. It improves our ability to recoup fraudulent unemployment insurance payments. It adopts minor changes that brings us into compliance with the federal law governing the unemployment insurance program. And non-compliance with federal guidelines carries serious financial risk for Alaska employers. And finally, it changes how the unemployment insurance tax rates are set in order to keep more money in the hands of Alaska's employers and employees while protecting the integrity of the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Paul Dick, the Director of the Employment Security Division, will now provide a section-by-section synopsis.
For the record, my name is Paul Dick. I'm the Director of the Employment Security Division, Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Senate Bill 25, Section 1 allows for the use of electronic filing in place of paper filing, and this is a section in the bill to allow for efficiencies in government and to allow technological changes for electronic filing. Section 2 authorizes the legislature to appropriate general funds to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Sections 3 and 6 are sections to bring the state into conformity with federal law prohibiting relief of charges to employers in negligent situations, removing the department's authority to waive penalties due to misrepresentation, and requiring 30% of penalty collections be deposited into the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. And I just want to underscore what Deputy Commissioner Bryn Keith had mentioned about the serious impacts of not being in conformity with federal law. Right now, employers enjoy a substantial credit for Federal Unemployment Tax Act, FUTA, tax contributions for each employee. And essentially, it's a 6% tax, and our employers, because we're in conformity with law, get a 90% credit. So rather than 6%, they pay 0.6% in FUTA taxes for every employee. That means about maximum $378 if we weren't in conformity, extra burden, $378 extra burden on employers in the state. It also means loss of our administrative funding, which is this year $21 million to administer the program.
Excuse me. Thank you very much. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At what point would we no longer be in compliance if this bill were not to be successful?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, the federal requirements are required to be in place October 21st of this year.
Thank you.
Continue, please.
All right. Section 4 makes changes to provisions relating to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund solvency, sometimes referred to in this bill as a surcharge. Currently, we calculate the surcharges to tenths of a percent. This bill would provide for the surcharges to be charged or calculated to hundredths of a percent. And this is a measure just to get more precision, more precise in the calculation of the trust fund solvency adjustment. It also removes a 0.3 annual limitation on decreases in solvency adjustments. Currently, the statutes require that the solvency adjustment can only increase or decrease 0.3 maximum per year. And this would allow for the decrease part to be eliminated. And we feel like this is in there because in times where the solvency adjustment can go down further, we're restricted to 0.3. If the calculation were to call for 0.4 or 0.5, we're restricted to that 0.3. And this, if we could go in decreasing situations down further, it'd provide more tax relief to employers. Section 5 authorizes the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development to suspend unemployment insurance tax rate increases when there's two conditions in place. One of those is when the average high cost multiple is 0.8 or greater, and after consultation with the department's actuarial staff. And this section is put in the bill to allow relief to taxpayers, tax relief, unemployment insurance tax relief to employers when most needed during usually economic downturns. Section 6 is a conformity section. Section 7 authorizes the department to participate in a federal offset program, which would allow us to offset unemployment insurance debts against federal income tax return refunds. And we project that that would bring in $500,000 on the offsets. Section 8 defines covered employment in conformance with federal statutory definition. And 9 through 12 deal with effective dates. I mentioned the October 21st dates and allows us to put regulations in place.
Thank you. You just want to open it for questions? Are you done with your testimony at this point?
Sorry.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
Questions from members of the committee?
One quick one, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Matricki.
So, Honorable, if we're at 0.8 on September 30 in the year, could you go below the last year's unemployment insurance rate? Is there a situation where that's possible?
Through the chair, Senator Matricki, this section only would apply to an increase in a given year, so you could not go below the rate that it was in the prior year.
But zero is the minimum, and you don't have...
Or the increase, if there were an increase, and if those conditions were in place.
Thank you.
Questions from members of the committee? Comments from members of the committee? We're going to open up public testimony at this time. And we have Barbara Huff with, I believe it's the Teamsters. Please come forward, state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Huff-Teknas. I am the Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959, and I appreciate you allowing us the time to testify regarding Senate Bill 25, the Unemployment Compensation Fund. To begin with, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to, for the record, address the fact that we represent about 7,000 members across the state. With respect to this particular bill, we represent employees, but in this bill we are also impacted as an employer out there as well. As an employer, we employ around the state about 35 employees. Two of the issues, I guess, that I'd like to talk about, for example, in 2012, as an employer, Teamsters Local 959, and this did not include our trust, either our training trust or our health and welfare trust, and those employees employed, paid about $37,000 into this fund. The employees that are employed by the local paid a little over $8,300. And as probably all the members of the committee are aware, we are one of three states that actually has employees as well as employers that pay into this trust fund. Over the years, this trust fund has been set up for different arenas, and including coverage of the unemployment benefits out there. There's also a portion of the funds that go into training across the state, and we think that those have been actually very, very positive implementations of the compensation trust fund in general. Prior to when I hope everybody has on file the letter dated February 12th that we had sent in. I had sent, when this bill was actually introduced, an email to Commissioner Bloomer asking several questions regarding, and there were concerns that we had about the bill. And honestly, I had thought that based on the responses of these questions that they would put our concerns to rest and we'd be able to come before you today and testify in support of the bill. Our concern specifically, as we stated in the February 12th letter, is focused directly around Section 5 of the bill. And I'd like to read, just for the record, one of several questions that we sent off to Commissioner Bloomer. If the rate increases are suspended, as referenced in Section 5 of the bill, and the average high cost multiple falls below the trigger, won't employers and employees be required to pay more than what they would have had the earlier rate increase been suspended? The response to that question, if rate increases are suspended, employers and employees would be required to pay slightly more in subsequent years than they would have if the increases had not been suspended in the earlier years. Over the long term, and I'll continue on with their response, over the long term, however, the amount paid by the employers and employees would be about the same or slightly less than if increases were never suspended. And I guess based on the response from the department, I appreciated the time and the effort that the department and their, I'm sure that their actuaries went in and took a serious look at this. If indeed, as an employer and employees that we represent out there ultimately end up, if there is a determination made to suspend this increase, ultimately, as an employer or an employee, we end up paying that increase down the road anyway. It's the question that we're raising, and maybe somebody gets a different answer. Why mess with a system that is tried and true? It has been working. If you look at this trust fund and compare it with the lower 48, there's between 30 and 35 unemployment trust funds in the lower 48 that have actually gone bankrupt, or they unfortunately went through insolvency and ended up borrowing money to fund those plans through the federal government, which of course the state ultimately is required to pay back. The formula that's set up with
I should have put the timer on, but if you can wrap up in a minute, that would be great.
Okay. I think we've addressed in hopefully a nutshell at least the issues regarding Senate Section 5 that we are concerned about. The other provisions of the bill we think are actually very positive changes that hopefully are for the good of everybody and for the betterment of the fund. And I thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Seth? Thank you very much. Next, we have Paul Grossi. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and we're going to try and limit things to 3 minutes if possible, okay?
For the record, I'm Paul Grossi, and I'm here representing the Alaska State Pipe Trades and also the iron workers. I would say we're in support of this bill. Yeah, I think most of the bill is just about allowing the Department of Labor to do their business. Our one concern, of course, is Section 5, and that is the allowing the commissioner or any commissioner in the future, when you make these changes, it could be for Well, the last time the formula was changed was in 1980, I think it was. So it's been in effect for quite some time. It's never, unlike most of the country, the Alaska, since they put in the formula, the Alaska trust fund has never been insolvent. And that's good. You know, that's a very good thing. Our concern is that we're risking just putting it, I don't want to sound like it's, you know, the sky is falling here. It could be, it could be relatively insignificant. But if there is a downturn in the economy, and we have allowed these, allowed the suspension of these increases for, a period of time, there could be insufficient funds to make up for the claims, the increased claims. Now, that's a slight problem for the claimants, in that they may, the benefits may be delayed. But what happens is, when an insolvency occurs, the federal government steps in. They pay, they make the claimants whole, and then the employer is responsible for making the fund whole again, or solvent. So, I guess our problem is, and it's not a problem, but it's a concern, is that that if ultimately this has to be reimbursed anyway, to a lesser extent and over a longer period of time, is this worth taking the risk on something on a formula that's proven? If the fund is overfunded, which is possible, the fund was designed back, 30, 40 years ago, and there were fewer employers, and so there may be, it may be that you could just tweak the formula to deal with those, changing demographics, and maybe the employers would get a break, and it wouldn't have any risk if you did it that way. I don't know the answer to that. I'm certainly not a financial person to get that. But you have people, both in the Department of Labor, and here with your finance director, who is, by the way, the person who designed the original formula.
If you can wrap up, Paul.
I would just say that we're in support of the bill. We think that most of the stuff in it is just things that the department needs. We're concerned about Section 5.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Is it Grassi or Grossi?
Grassi.
Grassi. Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Online, we have Andy Rogers, Anchorage, Alaska Chamber. Are you there, Andy?
I am, in fact. Can you hear me?
Yes. Please identify yourself for the record and give your testimony. It's going to be 3 minutes. Go.
Thank you, Chairman Dunleavy. I will try to keep it under 3 minutes. For the record, my name is Andy Rogers. I am the Deputy Director of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. The Alaska State Chamber of Commerce is a membership organization comprised of private sector businesses of all size, shape, and flavor from every corner of the state. Each year, our membership comes together to debate the merits of the various challenges facing employers, facing businesses across the state, and elects positions for the staff to advocate for. The membership of the Alaska Chamber has adopted a position on SB 25 and its companion in the House 76, and your staff should have letters of support to that effect. When employers see legislation that has an impact on required insurance payments that are made by the employers, that gets people's attention, and this one certainly did. We had the opportunity to have Deputy Commissioner Keith come and address Alaska Chamber membership and give a sectional analysis of the bill and respond to questions. Obviously, of interest to us as well was Section 5, but having reviewed that, we feel it's a fine mechanism to give to the commissioner that in times where the fund is solvent and there may be economic reason for there to be an interest to provide relief to Alaskan employers, to Alaskan businesses. It's not mandatory, but it's simply an option that's available to the department to provide some relief. I understand the potential for certain reluctance there, but there's a few things to take into consideration. Section 2, allows these legislature to make an appropriation to make the fund whole. Also, there's you can conceive of an economic downturn such that a slight mitigation to the potential increase may come into effect, but if we have a downturn that's significant enough, the fund is going to take a hit above and beyond what a modest addition to the increase would have provided anyway. I guess in wrapping up, the majority of this bill provides good cleanup. Again, I applaud the administration for doing good business on behalf of the state and looking for areas to optimize and seek efficiencies in the way that it conducts its business. We feel that HB 76 does that, and hope you pass this bill out of committee and it enjoys success on the floor as well.
Thank you. You're actually in it right on time. Any questions from members of the committee? Senator Machicki, any questions?
No, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if you had an intention of bringing the department back up. I might have a couple of questions for them.
Okay. Could the department come back up just for a moment?
We can wait till we're through with public.
Oh, it's okay. It'll go faster. This time I'd like to recognize Senator Egan, and Senator Egan is the sponsor for SB 8, which we'll be hearing as soon as we're done here. Please, Senator Machicki.
I like to listen to concerns that people have. To me, I agree with the next to the last person that testified that it's probably...
Mr. Rogers from Anchorage?
Next to last.
Mr. Grassi?
Yes, that probably the sky isn't falling, but it's a legitimate concern. My recollection is that of the lower 48 funds that didn't remain solvent had multiple years of huge unemployment challenges, which we've not had in Alaska, even including 87. Could you tell me if we need to adjust Section 5 or if you feel comfortable that the fund would remain solvent even under relatively challenging conditions?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, we do feel that Section 5, as it's written, maintains the solvency of the fund while allowing businesses and to some degree employers a little more money in their pocket, more money churning through the economy and hopefully creating jobs. We feel it strikes a very good balance, again, between keeping the solvent fund, and we have had excellent history with our unemployment insurance trust fund. We've not been lucky. It's very well designed. What Section 5 does is provides limited discretion to the Commissioner of Labor with significant sideboards so that discretion can be exercised in a very responsible way to protect the fund. So we feel it's, as written, a good move forward for employers and employees.
What is the typical, if you gave a 10-year average, what's the typical increase, or what's the typical contribution increase from year to year? If you sort of gave an average, is it generally?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I just want to emphasize the rate goes up and down. In the last 10 years, we've seen decreases and increases, and I haven't calculated an average, but I just wanted to emphasize that is the case. It has gone down, and over the history of the trust fund, it's gone, for the last 30 years, gone up and down as the economic times change and benefit requirements change.
Okay. So there could be a year or two when it's zero, and then you might have a fairly substantial increase for a year or two. But likely you would manage it year to year where there there wouldn't be a roller coaster. It'd be a pretty smooth ride. Is that what you're thinking?
Through the chair, Senator Micicci, yes. My experience in looking at the rates over the years, we haven't seen any dramatic increases or on the other hand, dramatic decreases over the history. I don't have that information available, but we've seen just this gradual increase to catch back up to the solvency, and then when we reach that level of solvency, then there's decreases to mm-hmm. I want to just emphasize the formula doesn't change under this legislation. There's a formula that says we need our trust fund at a certain level, sure. 3 to 3.3%.
I think we're holding the bill today.
Yes.
I do have a couple of questions. I would like to just see that 10-year term. Sure. It might make me more comfortable on the formula that we're looking at here.
Could you please get that to our my assistant, Steve?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Any more questions for now?
No, thanks.
Thank you. Last person we have listed here is Denny DeWitt, and I'm not sure if it's just for questions or are you testifying? Just for questions?
Do you
have any additional questions for Mr. Witt this time?
No, thank you.
Okay, so at that point, we're gonna lay the bill aside and we'll take it up at a later time. We're going to move back up the calendar to SB 8. And if Senator Egan could come forward, please. I'll take these guys here.
We no longer have a.
Take a brief at ease. Go to SB 8. It's sponsored by Senator Egan. SB 8 is an act establishing procedures and guidelines for auditing pharmacy records and providing for an effective date. This is the first hearing on the bill. Please note that this is a sponsor substitute, and presenting the bill is Senator Egan and his staff, Dana Owen. Take it away. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And I'm pleased to reintroduce this year's Senate Bill 8. Two important points right off the bat. Senate Bill, identical or close version of this bill, passed the Senate last year on a vote of 19-0. But because of end-of-session time constraints, it failed to pass the other body. The bill is not intended to stop the auditing of pharmacies, only to make those audits fair. Also, a sponsor substitute for SB 8 incorporates the result of discussions between pharmacy benefits managers, or PBMs, and pharmacists that took place earlier in the year. Both sides compromised to reach this result, though not every issue between them was resolved. Additionally, this bill incorporates request of the administration. Again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate you hearing this bill this year. And to explain the sponsor substitute for SBA, with your permission, Mr. Chair, I would like to have my staffer, Dana Owen, to briefly present the bill.
Yes, thank you.
Again, thank you.
Mr. Owen, please identify yourself for the record, and you can begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dana Owen. I'm staff to Senator Egan. The bill that you have before you, again, we worked on last year extensively. It had hearings in the Senate and passed the Senate 19-0. What you have this year is a slightly modified version of that. Earlier in February, we were instrumental in bringing together the pharmacists with the pharmacy benefits managers to talk about ways that they might be able to agree on some areas of the bill. We were not able to reach a conclusion on every issue, but we did make some progress. Many of the suggestions are incorporated into the sponsor substitute that you have. I'd like to read parts of the sponsor statement. You have it before you, but I'd like to get it into the record. Passage of sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 8 will establish procedures and guidelines for auditing pharmacy records so that all pharmacies are held to fair standards. It has been introduced at the request of the Alaska Pharmacists Association. Pharmacists acknowledge that audits are a good tool to protect the public and detect fraud or abuse, but sometimes audits are unreasonable and used in a way that deprives them of fair reimbursement for their services. In response to their history of pharmacy audit abuses, 22 states have now enacted reforms similar to those proposed in a sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 8. And I believe that number is now 23, and a bill has passed the Montana legislature and awaits the governor's signature. I also understand that a bill is moving in the Florida legislature. This legislation would help protect all pharmacies in Alaska, but it would be especially helpful to small business pharmacies, who, because of their smaller pool of assets, often face dire consequences from an unreasonable audit. Sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 8 would set requirements for auditing pharmacy records by an insurer, a managed care company, a third-party payer, or a pharmacy benefits manager. Supporters of this measure include the Alaska Pharmacists Association and the National Community of Pharmacists. The National Community Pharmacists Association. Since this writing, we've also received the support of the Alaska Nurses Association and the Alaska Nurse Practitioners Association. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I can walk you through the changes between the original bill and the sponsor substitute if you like. Otherwise, there's a short slideshow that we can take you through the bill, and however you'd like to proceed is okay.
Senator Maticki, what's your preference?
I think probably the presentation quickly would be helpful.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I can load up a slideshow of what you have in front of you, or if you want to move quickly, we can just work off the paper. That would be fine with us.
I'm a fine flipper, Mr. Chairman.
So okay. We can work off the paper.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the first slide is just lets you know that we're talking about pharmacy benefits managers and the need for fair and reasonable standards over the practice of auditing pharmacies. What's a PBM? PBMs are designed to reduce administrative costs for insurers, validate patient eligibility, administer plan benefits, and negotiate costs between pharmacies and health plans. What exactly do PBMs do? Employers and insurers sign contracts with PBMs to manage the pharmacy benefit provided to employees. PBMs then contract with pharmacies, and I put the word contract in parentheses, or in quotes, Mr. Chairman, primarily because, as I think you will hear from some of the pharmacists, these are not contracts as you and I might consider a business contract. They are essentially take it or leave it. Contracts, they can be changed at a moment's notice. We understand there may be some need for flexibility in this, but we don't want you to get the idea that these are actually negotiated contracts. You'll hear more about that, I'm sure, later. PBMs set pharmacy reimbursement rates. They also create a formulary, which is a list of approved drugs. They process pharmacy claims, and they reimburse pharmacies for dispensed drugs. Next slide demonstrates how it works. In step one, an insurer hires a PBM to manage drug costs. PBM acts as a go-between for both insurers and manufacturers and insurers and pharmacies. Step two, PBM negotiates prices with manufacturers. The manufacturers agree to prices and pay rebates to PBM for preferred placement on the insurer's formulary. PBM splits the rebate between the self and the insurer. Step three, pharmacy negotiates costs with manufacturers and wholesalers, how much pharmacies will have to pay to get the drugs. In step four, PBM negotiates insurer reimbursements for drugs and dispensing fees with pharmacies, how much pharmacies will earn for dispensing the drugs. and the next slide shows the Alaska pharmacy infrastructure. Total pharmacies are 94 in the state of Alaska. Independents, there are 40 chains, there are 59. Total community pharmacists are 273. Total employment, 11,469.
Just a quick note, Senator. We're on the slideshow where it says Alaska pharmacy infrastructure on that page. Please continue.
The next slide is what Alaskan pharmacists are up against. Today, 95% of consumers of pharmaceutical drug benefits receive these benefits through a PBM. Before the merger of two of the largest PBMs in 2012. Express Scripts, and Medco, the vast majority of benefits are managed by the Big Three. The Big Three equals Express Scripts, CVS Caremark, and Medco Health Insurance. Today, of course, there are only the Big Two. In 2011, Morgan Stanley reported that nine out of 10 of top employer health plans were managed by one of the Big Three PBMs. 2012 revenue of the merged PBMs and CVS Caremark, Express Scripts, Medco Health Solutions, 116 plus billion, CVS Caremark, 107 plus billion. And the point of those two slides, Mr. Chairman, is mostly just to show you what small community pharmacies are facing when they deal with a pharmacy benefits manager. Excuse me. Unfortunately, not all PBMs operate fairly. Examples of PBM tactics include non-transparent take-it-or-leave-it contracting, as I mentioned earlier, cell phone beneficiary-mandated mail-order operations, restricting beneficiary access to certain pharmacies, and lastly, predatory unregulated auditing of pharmacies. And, Mr. Chairman, it is that last that we concentrate on in this bill. SB 8 focuses on pharmacy audits. It's appropriate to audit pharmacies. However, PBMs that compete in the same market for the same consumers cannot ethically audit their competitors. And this refers mostly, Mr. Chairman, of something that I'm sure you will hear more about tonight, and that is mail order pharmacies. Auditors are required to be objective. Judgment should not be based on the interests of the auditor or the interests of others. PBMs, by nature of their business, cannot maintain objectivity when they're auditing their competition. SB 8 focuses on pharmacy audits. Even though they're important mechanisms for monitoring pharmacies and ensuring safe practices, audits should detect fraud, unlawful billing practices, and abuse. No one argues with that.
Great question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Chickie.
Previous slide, you said the third bullet point as though it's fact. Can you explain to me why that's fact?
I'm sorry. I didn't understand the question.
Yeah, PBMs, by nature of their business, cannot maintain objectivity when they are auditing their competition. Why is that a fact?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. If a PBM also operates a mail order pharmacy that's in direct competition with the pharmacy that they're auditing, it's a conflict of interest. Is that?
He's thinking.
Would be difficult to maintain objectivity would be an understandable statement. I'm not being difficult. I just wanted to know if there was some sort of process issue that made it impossible for them to be objective.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, no, I think this is referring basically to the mail order issue, and you will hear more about this from testifiers tonight.
Okay. Just a very brief at ease. It's just sure.
Okay, we are back. For the record, I'm vice chair, is acting chair, if you will, and you may continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Audits should detect fraud, unlawful billing practices, and abuse. They should also be standardized and conducted in a way that does not interfere with the healthcare services being provided by pharmacies. They should be adequately noticed, a minimum of 2 weeks. Use the same standards to audit similarly situated pharmacies. They should be conducted by or in consultation with a licensed pharmacist when decisions may involve clinical or professional judgment. We believe they should limit examination of claims to those within 2 years of submission. And they should base findings of over or underpayment on the actual amount. On the next slide, audits should not be held during the first 5 days of any month, be conducted within 90 days of a prior audit that found no fault, penalize a pharmacy because a prescription is mailed or delivered at the request of a patient, target simple administrative errors where no harm occurred and there was no financial loss or ill intent intended. They should not extrapolate costs, that is, use a probability equation to approximate how often an error might have occurred. And to wrap up, Mr. Chair, Alaskans should have confidence in how pharmacies are monitored. They should be monitored to ensure patient safety and uncover abuse or fraud. A monitoring goal should not be to increase the bottom line PBMs. And I'd like to give you one example. You'll hear more tonight. In August 2011, two auditors arrived at our store. I spent the entire day answering their questions, pulling files, and finding documentation. They are not very knowledgeable in pharmacy practices, so it took quite a long time. I was very pleased when I read the first few pages of the final report. Out of over $103,000 in claims reviewed, we had only $89 in errors. However, when I got to the last page, using the one-sided confidence extrapolation method, that's their name for this, they said I owed over $7,300. I called the auditors to no avail. Being told to repay over $7,000 is just not right. And that's a statement of Tom Hodel. He's the owner of Soldotna Professional Pharmacy. And I believe Mr. Hodel is online tonight. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to try and answer any questions. I know it's a bill that has very few sections, but it has a lot of paragraphs and a lot of provisions in it.
I'm taking that easy, Mr. Chairman. No.
Good. At ease. Continue. Do you have any other remaining information you'd like to pass on?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Dana Owen, staff to the sponsor, Senator Egan. I don't have anything further. I do have a letter that arrived just this evening, just as I walked in, and that I'd like to give to staff for distribution.
Perfect. How about just a quick, just a very quick sectional analysis? And we're hanging on to this. Well, we have people online. I think it's only fair, and then we'll make sure that they hear the testimony.
Okay.
If you can just give a quick, very quick sectional analysis for the record, that would be helpful.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, this bill has, as I said, very few sections. There are only three. The first section is the substantive section of the bill, and we have in that section three subsections, and the first subsection has 19 paragraphs in it. Those paragraphs are what carry all of the weight of the bill that have the actual provisions. It might be easier if I go through it from the perspective of where we made changes in the original bill, or I could walk you through each of those paragraphs if you like.
Well,
they're fairly self-explanatory.
I think what I would do is it'd be a good way when we have more of the committee here, when we have a quorum, it's probably a good refresher when we come back. So I think just briefly describing the sections would be helpful tonight, and then
we can
do a review when more of the committee's present.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, in Section 1 of the bill, starting on line 9, we get the first of the paragraphs. On line 5, we begin with Section AS08-8477, and this is a new section being added to our statutes. Subsection A, when an audit of the records of the pharmacy license in the state is conducted by insurer, etc., then we say that the auditor shall provide the pharmacy or pharmacist with notice. In this case, the notice is at least 2 weeks. And that's to give the pharmacy time enough to prepare. Many of these pharmacies have records that they have to keep in, have paper records. They may have to keep them in boxes. It may be a physical demand on them to pull those records together.
Sure.
In paragraph 2, we set the limit of the first 5 days of the month where no audits may occur. In model legislation and in other states, that limit is 7 days. We compromised with 5 at the request of the PBMs. Paragraph 3, we have the provision that an audit may not be conducted within 90 days after an audit that was clean. So you get three months before you have to be audited, or before you can be audited again if you had a clean audit. In paragraph 4, the audit of the claim must occur within 2 years after the date the claim was submitted. So there's a two-year look-back window. In paragraph 5, if the audit involves clinical or professional judgment, it's necessary to have a pharmacist licensed pharmacist either conducting the audit or helping to conduct the audit, or at least being consulted on the audit. In paragraph 6, this is the same standards for audits of similarly situated pharmacies. Again, the PBMs came to us with a suggestion that we hold that standard only to the same audit clients, so that they can set different standards if they're auditing on behalf of different clients. But if they have the same client, then similarly situated pharmacies would be audited with the same standards. In paragraph 7, we ban extrapolation as a method. We have heard from people in the industry that given today's electronic databases, searchable databases, that extrapolation is less used and should not be necessary, because we should be able to go back and, rather than estimate how many prescriptions may have been dispensed incorrectly, we should be able to go back and see exactly how many were dispensed and how they were dispensed. See, we're on paragraph 8, finding by an auditor of overpayment or underpayment shall be based on actual overpayment or underpayment. Number 9 deals with dispensing fees. In addition to the money charged for the prescription, the pharmacist, under their contracts, earns a dispensing fee. Those dispensing fees are oftentimes recouped when there's a mistake found or an error. And in this case, we're saying that that's still a practice, that you can recover it, but we've put limits on the cases in which you can recover it. I'd point out to you that when we talk about or pharmacy benefits manager, under the terms of the contract, except when the claim is fraudulent, this is exceptions to the provision, except when the claim is fraudulent, the prescription was dispensed as the result of a dispensing error by the pharmacy, or the identified overpayment is based solely on a dispensing, on an extra dispensing fee. Otherwise, the auditor of an overpayment may not include dispensing fees for a prescription that was actually dispensed. If you actually dispensed the prescription in the way that it was written out, and there was no fraud or error, then the dispensing fee cannot be recouped. In paragraph 10, this is the mail order provision. Pharmacies in Alaska, and I think we've all had, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure that we have all had the misfortune of having to explain to friends of ours and allies in other parts of the country that Alaska is in fact different. We do live differently here. We don't have a road system like they do in the lower 48. It's extremely difficult for people to conduct business in many parts of the state, particularly here in, I know here in the southeast. So we oftentimes have pharmacies that are where clients have requested that they mail a prescription to them. This has been one of the most contentious parts of the bill in trying to negotiate an answer to this. But we feel it's unfair to limit the number of prescriptions that a pharmacy can mail at the request of a customer. And I have no doubt we'll hear more about this evening. In paragraph 11, is that where we are? Paragraph 11. Yes. In paragraph 11, to the extent that an audit finds clerical or record-keeping errors in a required document or record, the pharmacy may not be subject to recoupment. And here we talk about, unless the clerical or record-keeping error results in actual financial harm to an insurer, managed care company, hospital, et cetera. In paragraph 12, the auditor shall deliver the preliminary audit report to the pharmacy within 120 days after the completion of the audit. And again, this just is to prevent people from hanging out indefinitely wondering what their obligation might be. Paragraph 13, during that period of time, no interest may accrue to either party. In paragraph 14, a pharmacy shall be allowed at least 30 days following receipt of a preliminary audit to produce documentation. We added the words, at the request of the pharmacy benefits managers, authentic and verifiable statement or record. Authentic and verifiable is added at their request. And we have some examples of the kinds of records that can be used. I would point out that in some of the other bills I've seen from other states, they do not limit it very tightly. It's a broad application of this idea that if you can produce a verifiable and authentic record, it really doesn't matter what kind of record it is as long as you can justify what you've done. In paragraph 15, the insurer, managed care company, hospital, etc., shall establish a written appeals process. Currently, we could ask others that come up to testify. I don't know how many contracts have an appeals process. I do know that there are many places in which these are just sort of catch-as-catch-can affairs. The person that's signing the contract really ought to be able to know in writing what the appeals process is going to be before they get an audit. In paragraph 16, the auditor shall deliver the final audit report to the pharmacy within 90 days after receipt of the pharmacy's response to the preliminary audit. The original language was simply 90 days after the preliminary report. This actually benefits the pharmacy benefits managers because the 90-day clock doesn't start until the pharmacist has responded to their original report, their preliminary report. In paragraph 17, the auditor may not receive compensation based on the percentage of the amount recovered by the auditor. I think we can all agree that auditors should be paid sufficiently for their work. They're professionals. They should be paid a professional amount. But a company who is employing auditors or who is an auditor on its own or who have contracted with an auditor should not be basing its profits on a recovery of or a piece of the action. We don't have any problem with people getting paid professional salaries, but the incentive there to harass and to blow minor accounting errors up into major costs is just too great if the compensation is being based on a percentage of recoverable money. In 18, the auditor shall provide a copy of the final report to a health benefit plan sponsor affected by the audit, if requested by the plan sponsor. Again, we added that last provision at the request of the pharmacy benefits managers. If a copy is not requested, they don't need to supply it. In number 19, patient information accessed in the course of an audit shall be kept confidential and may not be used for marketing purposes. The section does not apply to a criminal investigation or to state Medicaid programs. And in subsection C, health benefit plan has the meaning. We just refer to the statute of what that is. Section 2 is boilerplate. It just means that the pharmacy audits conducted on or after the effective date of the act fall under this. So there's no retroactive no retroactivity involved in this bill. Section 3 of the Act takes effect January 1st, 2014.
Okay. We have several people online. I think it's only fair if they've been waiting to complete public testimony, and we'll sure direct the other members toward the public testimony. But let's start. We're going to do... timing. One more. We have plenty of people to testify. I think we're going to do the timing at 2 minutes. And one moment. We'll start with Cindy Laubacher with Express Scripts. Cindy, if you can please state your name and your affiliation for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Cindy Laubacher with Express Scripts. I'm calling in tonight in opposition to Senate Bill 8. Actually, we have an oppose unless amended position. We have submitted a letter detailing our concerns with the bill. We do want to thank Mr. Owen and the pharmacist for sitting down with us earlier this year to talk about, to go through the bill and talk about its various provisions. We did, in fact, reach some agreement on several parts, but there are four major provisions that we continue to have, or five provisions we continue to have problems with. We believe the bill needs to be limited to on-site audits. We have issues with section or paragraph 3 regarding our ability to come back after 90 days. It's very rare, but we object to having that limited. We are doing audits for the purpose of identifying fraud, waste, and abuse. That is our job. That is what our clients expect of us under our contract. So we have concerns about any language that would limit our ability to go back if we start seeing some kind of triggers of problems. The issue that Mr. Owen talked about in paragraph 10 regarding mailing of a prescription, again, that's an issue that goes to our contracts with our clients who contract with us as a mail service pharmacy to provide that service. We don't object to it. We understand Alaska does have some unique circumstances, and as such, you know, we as from an audit perspective, we don't object to it on a one-off basis, and as long as they are meeting the requirements, you know, they're properly licensed to mail, because we have to be specially licensed as a mail service pharmacy, so they should have to meet the same requirements in order to mail, and it would need to be limited to mail within the state. So we've outlined our issues in our letter on that. With regard to paragraph 17 regarding compensation, that's decided by our clients. Our clients determine how to pay us. We do not pay our auditors who go into these pharmacies and to conduct an on-site, or even the folks who do desk audits. We do not pay them on a percentage basis. However, our clients may want to pay us. So we understand what the proponents are trying to get at. We've offered some language on that issue and would request the committee consider the language that we've offered there.
Ms. Laubacher?
Mm-hmm.
If you can wrap it up, please. You're over 2 minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry. And that's it. And then we have issues with the paragraph 19 regarding fraud. So with that, I'll thank you, and I'm available for questions.
And please feel free, if you have any additional testimony, you can certainly send it our way, but we do have your letter here. Thank you very much. Next is Barry Christensen, the Alaska Pharmacist Association. Mr. Christensen, if you can please state your name and identify yourself and affiliation for the record, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Senator Amicucci. For the record, my name is Barry Christensen, and I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 8. I'm a second-generation community pharmacist in Ketchikan, and I've worked with my father and our family on pharmacy. It's been the 40th year serving residents in Southern Southeast Alaska. Today I'm addressing you as state chair of the Alaska Pharmacists Association Legislative Committee on behalf of our association. We represent pharmacies, pharmacists, and pharmacy technicians in the state of Alaska. Our members work hard every day serving fellow Alaskans in retail pharmacies, hospitals, nursing homes, and clinic settings throughout the state. We are asking for your support today for this legislation that will help create a level playing field for pharmacists in dealing with pharmacy audits. This bill represents a modified version of last year's SB 217 that passed the Senate at the end of the session but died in the House. Over the summer, our association met with the Commissioner of Administration, which provided substitute language in the bill, which is introduced as HB 8 by Senator Olson and now SB 8 by Senator Egan. In addition, we have met in good faith with our opponents this session, which has resulted in this compromised piece of legislation. I believe this bill in its current form represents the bottom line of what Alaskan pharmacists feel is needed to bring fairness to the unregulated and expanding practice of pharmacy audits. Let me assure you that our association supports the needs for audits to ensure that fraud, waste, and abuse activities are checked. Nothing in SBA interferes with that process. The bill before you today is before you today because we need clarity. We are asking the common sense standards be put in place to review our work, like there are in 23 other states. In closing, this legislation has the support of small mom-and-pop pharmacies, larger chain pharmacies, and the Alaska State Board of Pharmacy. We are all asking for this legislation to help keep our businesses viable, providing jobs to Alaskans while serving Alaskans. You have the opportunity to bring fairness to the practice of pharmacy arts. On behalf of our membership, thank you for your time and for your favorable consideration since we need relief now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Again, please feel free to forward on your written testimony. We have three people in the room. Let's switch there, then we'll go back to the off-net. In the room is Mr. Fred Brown. Mr. Brown, you have, if you can please introduce yourself and your affiliation, you've got 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Fred Brown. I'm the Executive Director of the Healthcare Cost Management Corporation of Alaska. Given the limitation on time, I'll refer you to the letter, which was dated March 28th, and I expect is in your packets. Let me just comment with respect to a couple of points, if I may. Our members are total about 38 or so health benefit plans in Alaska and the Pacific Northwest. When there's talk earlier about how the clients are insurance companies, I want to clarify that these organizations consist primarily of state, borough, municipal, school district-sponsored plans. These are self-funded plans. Taft-Hartley Health Benefit Trusts also participate in our organization. There are over 72,000 employees and 171,000 covered lives throughout Alaska and the Pacific Northwest. About 40%, or something over 40% of that total, live and reside and work in Alaska, consisting of over 10% of Alaska's population. So the clients we're talking about in substantial part are these self-funded plans consisting of organizations here in Alaska. I would also like to mention that with regard to the sponsors' goal of achieving reasonable audit standards, we're not opposed to that at all. We certainly support the idea. We would ask, however, that we be invited to the discussion concerning how to accommodate the concerns of the various parties. We've not been invited thus far, to my knowledge. We don't think the bill is balanced at the moment, and we would like to see a balance brought to the fore. Again, there's a letter that describes our current opposition to the bill, and I would refer the committee to that letter. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. And the bill is in the pack. I mean, the letter is in all of our packets, support letter. Next, I believe Ms. Huff-Tuckness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Barbara Huff-Tuckness. I'm Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs, and I'll be as brief as I can be. Senate Bill 8 Pharmacy Audit. For the record, we do have a letter in the file also. Should have been actually sent from on behalf of Rose Calamarides, who is our director of our Alaska Teamster Health Plan. A couple of things that I would like to reiterate out of that. Number one, and we had a letter that was sent to us. I guess I'd like to actually thank Senator Egan and Dana, his staff, for being able to participate in the discussions and some of the changes that actually did occur. We would like to hope that there are additional changes that will make this bill even better, that allow our PBMs that we do hire to reduce cost. In the past year, our health plan experienced 30% increase in cost. We paid out $42 million in health benefits. Of that, 12% was prescription drugs. It's huge. It's a huge issue for us. We hire the PBMs to hopefully reduce our cost.
with respect to the audits and those processes. Our only concern as we're moving through with this bill is that the PBMs that we hire be allowed to do the jobs that we've hired them to do. And with all respect to the pharmacist, definitely we would recognize that there would need to be, and there should be, those fair practices. In all of the years, and we can go back to 1980, we've had PBMs. We have never had a pharmacist nor a pharmacist who has actually complained about the PBM.
I'll give you a few extra seconds.
Anyway, with that, we'd at least like to go on record that we do oppose this bill, and we're hoping that with maybe some ongoing discussion amongst the groups that we can iron out some of those disagreements until our PBM is able to actually operate effectively and efficiently in the state of Alaska. We cannot support Senate Bill 8 as it is in its current form. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Next in the room, and I'm sorry, it's difficult to read the last name, but Patricia.
My name is Patricia Center, and I'm the Professional Practice Director for the Alaska Nurses Association, and I'm also a member of the Alaska Nurse Practitioner Association. You should have letters of support from both our President, Susan Walsh from Ketchikan, and from Robin Bassett, the Nurse Practitioner President in Anchorage. We have been involved with the pharmacists this past year. It seems like they are under assault from many sides. We've been dealing with changes in the Medicaid reimbursement things for Medisets and the proposed discontinuation of paying the dispensing fees for Medisets. There are regs about regulating from the federal government about how much pharmacies can cost and charge for different medicines. And so this, the audits are just an added piece in the threats to our local pharmacies. For this, we think that there should be basic rules of engagement between the auditors and the pharmacies, and we think that this bill does a good job of that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Next, that's it for in the room, unless there's anyone in the room that I've missed that would like to testify. Okay, and we go to back to the off-net, Mr. Selby, CBS Caremark.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, I have a cold, so if you can't hear me, let me know. My name is Mike Shelton. I'm a pharmacist with CVS Caremark. And we met with the Pharmacist Association to find common ground, but there are still five sections that we find troubling. The very first one is to limit the bill to on-site only. This will allow how PBMs go about doing their audits and will allow to make sure the audits themselves are done appropriately. Also, strike the section that states you cannot audit for 3 months for errors. We find this is also, you know, we cannot tie our hands on how we can research into the errors. Next, the third thing is adopt limitation for mail for retail pharmacies. We don't want mail pharmacies to flock to Alaska for these type of rulings, so they have many, many more opportunities to use Alaskan methods. The fourth one is just for laying on your lane to audit your payment. We agree that it should not be paid on a bounty. We definitely should have aggressive results that meet the goals of paying claims appropriately. Fifth one is CVS Caremark training will use their need to be provision for potential FWA to be reviewed quickly. We have issued a letter. It's in your document in front of you. For time's sake, and I'm about to lose my voice, that's it for CVS Caremark.
Just in general, your philosophy that you were in opposition or support of Senate Bill 8?
Yeah, I'm sorry, thank you. We are in opposition.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Selby. Then next is Matt Diaretto, National Community Pharmacist. Mr. Diaretto? We will check back with Mr. DiRetto. Next is Julie McDonald, Prince of Wales Island.
I'm sorry. Are you reading me now?
I am reading you now. If you can wait.
Okay.
I'm
sorry. I'm on my cell phone. I must have hit a spot there. This is Matt DiRetto with the National Community Pharmacists Association.
Okay.
And I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 8. We've been working with the Pharmacists of Alaska for about 2 years now on this legislation. I personally have worked in a number of other states, 23 states currently enacting legislation, and about three successfully moving legislation through different state committees over the past week alone. I know time is limited, so I just wanted to point out a couple things that we've been hearing from the opposition of this bill, most notably the cost increase that some are claiming this will cause. The fact is that pharmacists do not set the reimbursement. Nothing in this bill has to do with the cost of medications or the cost of services provided. Pharmacists actually don't even get to identify their dispensing fees. And also, I know some union plans are opposing this legislation in Alaska, and we reached out to them, and I know they responded to Senator Egan's office, but in fact, this is the first time NCPA has ever worked in a state where a union plan has opposed one of these pieces of legislation over the cost argument. And again, I know time is limited, so I would just like to point the committee to one other thing that actually just came out in the past 48 hours. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services actually released a call letter bringing attention to they actually state that CMS is concerned the growing practice of post-audit claim recoupments from pharmacies is distorting plan payment and compromising plan data integrity and impairing their ability to oversee the program. In other words, they actually stated that the recoupment of this money may be related to the incentives and contingency reimbursement arrangements with plan audit vendors. It's an extensive document. We can provide it to you, but in summary, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services is noticing that abusive audit practices are occurring, and they're bringing attention to this issue. So we ask that the committee take favorable action on this bill. We are happy to work with any groups that want to discuss this, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Feel free to forward your written testimony if you have any. Appreciate that. Next is Julie McDonald. Julie, are you on the line?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can, just fine. You have 2 minutes.
Great. For record, my name is Julie McDonald. I'm a pharmacist at Whaletail Pharmacy in Craig. Our pharmacy has been in business for over 11 years and is the only pharmacy for Prince of Wales Island. As a non-owner pharmacist in rural Alaska, I wanted to state my support for Senate Bill 8. To be clear, myself and I'm sure many other pharmacists do not actually oppose audits themselves. We simply want audits to be done in a fair manner that does not infringe on our ability to provide direct patient care. From my personal experience negotiating and reviewing contracts for our pharmacy, I have observed contracts such as one large insurance company within the state where the audit section of the contract already 100% complies with the provisions of Senate Bill 8. Therefore, the proposed regulations and standards are not unreasonable for insurance companies. However, more nationwide insurance companies, especially those that own their own pharmacies, are not acting in such a manner that making Senate Bill 8 necessary. What will occur is the information on how audits will be handled will be put into what they call a provider manual rather than the contract itself. This provider manual can be amended at any time without the consent of the pharmacy. Another common issue is the audit terms will be placed in the contract, but when a pharmacy tries to amend these terms, the insurance company will not respond. One insurance company faxed Whaletail Pharmacy a contract in early August. I immediately amended the section, sent it back to the insurance company, and I heard nothing. I have called and emailed this company every single Friday since the end of August, and to date have still been unable to speak to anyone from the contracting department. A lower-level representative said if we were a chain of three or more, he could directly connect me with the account manager. But since I was just one store, all he could do was send internal requests. I've had them send 26 internal requests in addition to my calls and emails, but in 7 months, I've had no response, therefore no contract. So the fact that pharmacies can amend audit terms in contracts is not accurate. This means our pharmacy has been left with between two hard decisions. Either we accept terms that are unfavorable to our pharmacy and put us in jeopardy of being closed, or we leave our patients with no access to a local retail pharmacy that accepts their plan. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. McDonald. Next on the list, actually, brief at ease. Next on the list for public testimony is Mr. Tom Hodel of Soldotna Professional Pharmacy. Mr. Hodel?
Yes, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine. You have 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Machichi. For the record, my name is Tom Hodel, and I've been the owner of Soldotna Professional Pharmacy for 29 years now. We currently employ 28 people. And several of the things I was going to mention tonight have already been spoken for, so I'll just make this short. I am in support of Senate Bill 8. Pharmacies are not attempting to do away with audits, as they are certainly a necessary mechanism to protect against fraud and abuse and ensuring safe practice. All we are asking for now is some fairness to this process. As Mr. Owen spoke to earlier concerning our audit in 2011, the 100 prescriptions that we had audited were all from the year 2008, so most of them were back in files, and it took a lot of time to get them out of there. Then they used this extrapolation formula with the over $7,000 they wanted in recoupment. I ended up having to hire a lawyer, and after several months, we just settled on a $4,000 payment just to get it over with, and this whole process took over a year. Yesterday, CMS stated in its proposal in a draft call letter that Medicare D plans can only recoup the full amount of a prescription claim under certain circumstances. These include fraudulent claims, duplicate claims, excluded provider, or the lack of a valid prescription. They do not include clerical or administrative errors. Senate Bill 8 will only bring some fairness to this expanding practice of audits. It does not protect those who are abusing the system. This will allow pharmacists to spend less time in paperwork and more time focusing on their patients' health and welfare. Thank you for this time, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hodel. And I believe we have a letter from you as well in the packet. Next is Mr. Dick White from Sitka. Mr. White?
Yes, good evening. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Thank you very much. Again, my name is Dirk White. I'm a pharmacist, and my wife, a pharmacist as well, and I run two pharmacies in Sitka, and we employ 38 people, and we are the only retail pharmacies on the island and provide services and have been providing services here for approximately 30 years. One of the things that's come up already is a clause in this legislation, and I would like to first off say that I stand in support of the passage of this legislation. The clause that's in contention is whether or not we are allowed to mail prescriptions to our constituents. And that's a real critical issue, and when we were in our conference with everybody and trying to iron out our differences, and when we came up with what we have currently in front of you, that was a real sticking point, and when they said, oh, well, you really can't mail or send out prescriptions, and I said, well, how am I going to get a prescription to one of my patients who's gone to St. Petersburg to visit family for a month, and they run out of their medication, and they said, well, they can get it from mail order. I said, well, it's not going to get to them in a timely fashion. Or somebody's gone to Cake or Angoon, and or even Little Port Walter, and I send out a prescription on an EAC, or I send it out on Harris Air on a float plane. Those are all services that mail order cannot cover, and they're saying, well, we can't do that. So how am I going to be able to serve my constituents, my patients? Yeah, and that it's interesting to see that CMS lab has courted a couple of times as well, and these abuses of our prescriptions. Being a Board of Pharmacy member, and I'm not speaking yet for the board, but some of these prescriptions are totally valid prescriptions under the rules and regulations of the Board of Pharmacy. Yet the insurance and the PBMs are saying that they're invalid due to a clerical error, so that they'll recoup the money. Now, if it's a totally valid prescription as far as the Board of Pharmacy is concerned, and the patient has received the correct medication that the physician wrote for, and they took the medication correctly, then how is it that a PBM gets to come along and determine that, well, that's not a valid prescription?
Mr. White?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to have to ask you to, you're a little bit over on time, if you can wrap it up, please.
No problem. No problem. I would appreciate your service and taking the time to listen to me.
Oh, you bet. Thank you.
I'll answer questions if anybody has any.
I don't think we're having questions tonight. Thank you very much for your testimony. Hate to cut you off when you were just getting on a roll.
No problem.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the room or online that would like to testify? No? Seeing none, the public testimony is closed. We will meet again tomorrow to have confirmation hearings on the governor's appointees. Here, Senate Bill 93, House Bill 71, Senate Bill 58, and have another hearing on Senate Bill 25. I'm not going to speak for the committee on Senate Bill 8. I assume we'll hear it tomorrow or Saturday, and we will get that notice out as soon as possible. So with that, we are adjourned at 6:40 p.m.